Post show.
You know, one thing that I didn't get a chance to ask everybody during the... It's funny, because we had a huge thing I didn't ever ask anybody this. Maybe I was too nervous. Was whether
How
my...
How big is your dick?
That was the one Jeff
did. Can I see it?
I wanted to ask whether any of my science stuff... And I didn't listen to the pre-show, post-show, and I thought any of my science stuff was interesting, or whether I just skipped past it or whatever. I mean, I obviously have a
Greg likes science.
I obviously enjoy spreading it, and I enjoy the feeling that I'm telling people and giving them something to think about and learn on. But yeah, I don't know.
The only feedback I could give you is, and sometimes my eyes glaze over. There's sometimes you're going into some really deep stuff, and if you're going to go super deep, you better have a great analogy.
It's really hard because it gets more interesting the deeper you go, but the deeper you go, the less there are good analogies. Mm-hmm. So that's the real problem. That's the fundamental problem with science, is that there's so much interesting stuff beyond that curtain, but beyond that curtain lies madness like you've never seen before.
Exactly.
Stuff that you have never witnessed and you have never experienced. You have no way of comprehending it other than base analogies, which don't work.
That's why Neil deGrasse Tyson and Mikio Kaku don't talk about those things, right, because they can't describe them to the layperson.
I try my best. I really have.
I mean, Brian Greene is the guy that tries to describe the hardest stuff to the layperson.
But he does a horrible job of describing this so-called hardest stuff, because what he describes is nothing like what is in the theory.
Okay.
What's in the theory is so radically different from what he describes. It's funny. For example, I asked you about string theory. Does string theory have strings in it?
There's vibrating pieces of energy.
Those are not in string theory.
Oh. Damn it.
It's so different that what he's doing is he's making an analogy to something that comes within a mile or two. But when it's a game of inches and it comes in a mile or two, those mile or twos really matter.
Okay.
So yeah, it's so hard to say. That's why I found the Higgs stuff so kind of infuriating, because here was a subject that was ripe for talking about and people wanted to know what this was. And every single explanation that came along was wrong. Just completely wrong. Wrong. Like 2 + 2 = 6 wrong. That's the level of wrongness.
Is it that wrong, or is it more like when you first learned about atoms in, you know, first level chemistry where they told you...
Isn't that 2 + 2 = 6 wrong?
I mean, you know, when they're talking about the
idea that there's
orbitals versus the shells or something.
Yeah.
Well, not orbitals, but the, you know, when they actually show you, you know, the rings or whatever, as opposed to the shells, you know, it's... And they tell you, when they teach you the shells, you're like, oh, the rings were wrong, you know.
But you learn that the shells are different, and you learn that the electrons aren't actually little points traveling around. Mm-hmm. You can't describe them in otherwise except your math, because they're spread out and they exist in these multiple places along this wave function. And The entire idea of describing these things in a way that makes sense, just the bottom falls out, and the rabbit hole just goes deeper and deeper and deeper. And the thing about the science rabbit holes, it doesn't end. There's no end to this rabbit hole. It just keeps going down deeper and deeper. But the stuff that's there will blow your fucking mind.
If you can understand it.
If you can understand
it. That's why you need good analogies. To help everyone else understand it,
and that's what I've been trying to do. Like, you know, the analogy I provided that was about the electric coil is much closer to the way the Higgs operates than the analogy with you're in a crowded room and you're moving through something. You have to keep in mind this is a relativistic field that we're talking about. So if it was a non-relativistic field, then you'd be able to compare against it and have it as a defining point in space that you could then say everything was moving with respect to this field. All of a sudden, relativity would break down.
Today I was, I think Allison got it. We took her globe of flashlight and went into the bathroom without it, you know, the powder room without any windows, and I tried to show her how day and night works. It's funny, you know, when you talk with a four-year-old, though, she's, because she asked me about, you know, when we're awake here, people are sleeping somewhere else, right? I'm like, yeah, here, let me show you how that works. And I'm wondering if she got it, but what was the one thing she, like, asked a couple times about, oh, Santa Claus lives at the North Pole type things, you know, stuff like that. Like, oh, Santa Claus lives up here.
Well, so she's, I mean, you know, she's not, she gets it on some level. She understands that you're trying to teach her something. And so she's trying to play with it as much as possible. Yeah, you should let her.
I think that's it, yeah.
And, you know, let her do her play, but also intersperse her play with things. And then the things will simply add up in her mind.
Right. Yeah, so it was fun because I think she was, yeah, I had her attention for a long time for a four-year-old. And, you know, showing her, like, look, here's what happens when morning happens. See how this, you know, Pennsylvania is a little purple square. So I'm like, see how this is in the dark? And when it turns around, it gets into the light. And then over here, it goes into the dark. She's like, yeah, I see that. So
she'll need reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
But she'll get it. And you have a good attitude towards getting it. Hold on a second. I'm writing you the notes.
Okay. And then she wanted to know about, or she asked about, like, you know, who lives, you know, over here. I'm like, you know, so like, I'm like, daddy knows, has a friend in New Zealand, you know, Greg, our listener from New Zealand. I'm like, how does he get all the way over there? And I'm like, daddy worked here. And I pointed at India. And like, you went there for work, you know, like a long time ago. It was a long trip. It took a long time to fly there. Like, you flew in an airplane? I'm like, yeah. So, yeah, she has no way appreciates how far away India is.
No.
I didn't even appreciate how far away India was until I looked at, like, on the globe, like, wait, I flew from there to Frankfurt to Singapore to Bangalore. Holy crap.
Hey, I've been to Japan. That's mm-hmm. pretty far away.
Yeah.
Not quite as far away as, say, Australia, but pretty far away.
Mm-hmm.
You've been to India. A little bit further away, I think, than Japan.
Yeah, well, and you flew across the Pacific, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so I flew across the Atlantic and across Asia.
Yeah.
So I think it was probably, I forget how many hours it was, but I'm guessing that was probably a longer distance traveled.
Yeah, it was about 13 hours on my plane. 15 hours against the wind, 13 hours with.
Yeah, mine wasn't a single, you know, single stop or anything like that, but I was like 20 or something like that, 21.
Yeah. I mean, what's amazing to us is that, yeah, you'll be there in, you know, 20, 21 hours when 70 years ago, it'd be a boat that would take you a month.
Yes.
You have to travel around the Horn of Africa. I mean,
yeah, 20 hours wouldn't be horrible if you weren't cramped in a tiny little seat, though.
Well, they got to be efficient.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so, I mean, it was fun, you know, teaching Allison very simple science, but, you know, trying to demonstrate, you know, like, let's find a flashlight, let's take the globe into the dark room so you can actually see the terminus and things like that. And it worked out pretty well. I did give her a brief... I didn't think she would get seasons, summer and winter.
Yeah.
I gave her a brief overview of it, but I didn't really expect her to understand what I was trying to show her for seasons.
No, that's a little abstract. Because then you have to picture yourself sort of outside.
Well, no, I had a globe, so I was showing how the angle of the Earth.
Yeah, but you have to picture things like, oh, there's more sun here, so that would be hotter. And... Mm-hmm. Then you had to picture things.
Well, I did show her, like, how the Arctic Circle is in the sun all day and all night, you know. But, again, for a four-year-old, that's... Again, that was more so, yeah. Let's just tell her that this exists. And again, maybe she'll get it later.
For those of you who are saying, well, Mozart made symphonies and it was four. Well, he was a fucking genius of a singular order. And he was probably had like huge Spurg. He probably was major Asperger's.
Yeah, Allison's not making symphonies. What's up?
I did one before you got in. Yeah.
I can do a couple of those.
It's hard.
He has a little cup and ball game, a little Christmas thing. It's in our Christmas.
F.A.O. Schwartz thing. Oh, almost.
No, you're not doing it right, though. The easier way is to try to keep the ball, give the ball a little jerk so it's kind of just hovering in air, and you want to put the cup under the ball, not right. Throw the ball into the cup. Because what you're doing, the ball's coming down too hard. Even if you land it direct in the cup, it's going to bounce out. You want to catch the ball at its peak. Yeah, it's perigee. Apogee. Whatever. You want to catch the ball at the peak when it's not moving and slide the cup in underneath.
What I did is I actually did like that, but made it shorter, and I was able to do it that way.
Here, let me see that. And even though this is wonderful radio, let me show you the technique that I find is more successful. Even though I'm not sure I'll be able to do it right now. So.
Oh, I see. Jeff's doing a quick jerk.
I let the ball hang until it's not moving and give it a quick jerk and try to put the cup underneath it. And that's my strategy I find more successful.
He does the slinky method, essentially. Because if I were to drop this...
Oh, is there a knot? Did I tie a knot in that thing?
You did, but I can untie that. But for the purposes, I can demonstrate this.
But if you start jerking, the knot's going to get tighter and tighter.
But I'm not going to jerk it.
Okay.
If I take this and I drop it... It didn't work out exactly like I thought it would. Huh. It's different with the slinky.
Well, there's that whole thing about the top of the slinky doesn't know what the bottom of the slinky
is
doing.
Right, but you know why the difference is? Because there, the string is protecting the slinky. That's right. Okay, it's a different situation. What's going on there? So if you take a slinky, you let it drop. Then you sort of hold the top and you let it drop as far as it's going to go without touching the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And you let the slinky drop. It will compress and hit the top before the bottom hits the ground. The same thing does not happen with that.
The bottom won't start falling. You would think it would. You think everything, but because there's that spring compression in there, the bottom is at equilibrium when you're holding it, and when you let go, it's a little bit anti-intuitive because for some reason the equilibrium keeps the bottom there for a while as the top is coming down, and then the whole thing starts to drop eventually.
Right, because what it's doing is it's waiting for the information, weirdly, for the information that the top of it is starting to hang, because that part, the bottom, has that tension with the top, so it's mm-hmm. based on that. Now, the reason why that string didn't behave the same way is because essentially you have two independent bodies there. You mm-hmm. have the top of it and the string, which is holding it onto the ball at the bottom. Mm-hmm. The bottom does not care what the thing is doing. In fact, the bottom just wants to drop as far as it can. It only doesn't because the string isn't there. As soon as you let it, it drops.
Right.
Whereas with the...
Well, you would assume with the slinky, you know, just gravity, the whole thing will start to fall. But because of the compression on the string, there's more tension in the spring than the pull of gravity. So the bottom actually stays. Now, when Neil deGrasse Tyson described this, he made it sound blow your mind because the bottom doesn't have the information that the top has been let go, so it doesn't know it can fall yet. And that when you start talking about like speed of light type stuff, you know, that whole information thing, you know, it's like, whoa, man, the slinky knows how to like do this. But it's kind of more of a coincidence of the equilibrium of the tension of the spring, I think.
You know, it's more related to the tension of the spring. It's more related to the fact that electrostatic repulsion is a lot stronger than gravitational repulsion. So the fact is that there's electromagnetic thing that's set up with this spring
now,
that
is considerably stronger. Now, what Neil deGrasse Tyson said about information is true with this string.
Yes.
We just can't see it.
Yes.
Because it's so quickly. When I let go of the handle, it does fall. And it does take the speed of light for the ball to know that I've let go of the handle before it starts falling. But you can't see that. With the slinky, that's not the effect you're seeing.
Yeah.
But Neil deGrasse Tyson said that's the effect. Or was it Michio Kaku? I forget whoever said that. I think it was Neil deGrasse. He said that was the effect you're seeing. That's a representation of, that's a layman right. analogy yeah. of this effect.
Yeah, the speed of light over that period is very fast.
Very fast. Yeah.
That blows your mind, man.
Yeah, it does. I was having a discussion with my parents' sister on the way back from Philadelphia, and we were... I forget, I don't know how it exactly came up, but the concept of extraterrestrial life.
And my argument that I don't feel like intelligent life is all that likely to happen. And they had their counter argument. I said, you know, well, how do you know? There's, you know, and I agree with them that life is most likely very common, but I just said that, you know, intelligent life doesn't know. I said, you don't know. You don't know all things out there. And it's true, I don't know. But they also agree with me that it's true that I probably will never know, simply because of the way the world is. And my argument to them, my point to them, was that if you're just out there and you're looking for aliens, I guess it may be sad, the idea that we can never do things like warp. We can never do things, mm-hmm. you know, we can never break the speed of light. That's just the way the universe is. Every time I say, when I said design, they yelled at me for saying it. I was like, yeah, you're right. The way in which the universe has developed precludes the option for moving faster than light. And that is sad in some ways, but I think it's also kind of amazing. Especially once you realize how chemical structure, how everything is sort of tied up in the same basic equation.
Mm-hmm.
In all this E equals MC squared stuff, there's us. And so, yeah, there's a speed limit the universe puts on the way information travels. But being able to explore that and being able to do what we can do and being able to because of that, get the light out of stars.
I think we're going to find intelligent mermen on Europa.
I did say that... You know, if you want to explore a new area, there's a whole amazing new area to explore full of life that we have barely touched, and that's the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you want to explore, there's where you go. There's going to be things there you ain't never seen before.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, with all the exploration we have had, you would think we've seen all the living critters, but, I mean... Like, most of the new species they find are just variations of things we know. Right. Oh, look, a monkey that's technically speciated from its, you know, the ones we knew about. No big deal. But there's a...
And there are like 800 different types of spiders. There are like...
Yeah.
There's a huge number of different species, but...
But, you know, there's things in the ocean that no one's ever really seen a giant squid do what a giant squid does.
They recently had somebody recently found a video of a giant squid alive,
mm-hmm.
not doing what it does, but a giant squid actually alive. But there's things in the ocean. I mean, we've only explored like at most 5% of the ocean. I mean, it's hard to imagine that because you think, well, we explored most of the planet. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's only 30% land on the planet.
And the ocean's 3D.
Yeah. There's whole worlds. I mean, if particle physics has taught me anything, it's that there's whole worlds at all levels. There's amazing and wonderful and strange things going on at levels that you thought would be extraordinarily simply mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happens on just a level under our feet. The thing that's going on in the first 2 or 3 inches of soil is an entire world full of life and death and... And predators and prey, mm-hmm. and you know, all types of stuff.
Yep.
That barely has any interaction, as far as we're concerned, with our world, and yet without it, we wouldn't exist.
Now I'm depressed. I wish I would have went into science research or something like that. Or Indiana Jonesing or something.
I told my parents I should have been a physicist. And the reason why I said this is because, well, not only just this show, but also like when I'm describing the diet to people that I'm on, what I don't talk about is what I ate last week or what, you know. Stop balancing toys while I'm giving a lecture.
Sorry about that.
I don't talk about, you know, what I've eaten or what I'm going to eat or things like that. What I talk about is the mechanics. I talk about how it works. I talk about what it does in your body to work. You know, I talk about those things. When I look at something, what interests me is how it works. There is an impetus behind everything I do to sort of figure out those things. There are exceptions, and there are things where it's like I realize if I tried to get into how that worked, I might get lost in it, so I don't even bother. For example, automobiles. I bet I could really get a fine grasp on what goes on inside automobiles to the point where I can fix things and whatever. But there's only so much a brain can hold.
When it gets into the electronic sensors and things, that's where that's where the old school gearhead, you know, just mechanic, you know, like I understand how internal combustion engine works, you know, kind of falls apart because, sure, you can understand the whole internal combustion thing, but what about this sensor that's checking the oxygen levels and the computer that is reading that sensor and managing the fuel injection? And
but even in stuff that you might think might be related, like, for example, I am getting into and I'm starting to learn more and more and read more and more about basically high-energy particle physics. But there's a whole bunch of other stuff. There's solid-state electronics. There's semiconductor physics. There's superconductor physics. There's all types of things that I really don't have a grasp on at all, how they work. And these are, you know, rarefied specialized fields. So I just, you know, decided to go on to one area that I found most interesting. But the fine... the fine points of how a superconductor work are still a mystery to me.
For me, you know, the one piece of magic that I wish I could understand, like it intuitively understand and just get, is radio.
Radio.
I don't know, just like, I mean, maybe because it's just so common and everyone knows what a radio is. And like, I can, you know, I get
the weird basics. Thing is you do get it. Because that light is the same thing as a radio transmitter. It just is doing it on a slightly different frequency. So and these eyes are antennas.
Well, sure, but no, here's the more, like, for you know, a specific example is here at my house, when a certain radio station is broadcasting normally, it comes in fine.
Right.
When its tower is down or, you know, not broadcasting at peak strength, it doesn't come in, and a radio station from somewhere else pushes into the area and you can hear that. Mm-hmm. Why does this radio station push the other signal out and not, why isn't there interference when it's working normally? And then when it's not working strong enough, do I hear the other radio station? Why aren't I hearing like all kinds of static interference on both of them?
Well,
why,
two things.
Why can the local radio station overpower the other one? You know,
that has to do with the way your radio itself is built.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way the tuning in the antenna works in order to tune in on specific frequencies and the crystal there that's designed to, you know, vibrate the right frequency to tune in on that. But there's also SEC law, which is, and I don't know whether it's still the case, but it was the case for a long time, that a lot of AM stations that had to be very powerful when the sun's out, because the sun itself is shining a lot of light in all types of frequencies, they are mandated to go less powerful when the sun.
No, this is FM. This, you know, I understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is FM, but it's just like when it was when 90.5 was having some tower troubles or something like that. They were down one morning And like this Christian station out of Ohio was coming in loud and clear on the same frequency.
Right.
And like, if it's that strong now, why, what isn't there interference? You know, why, what, like, it almost seems like when the closer one is broadcasting normally, it creates this bubble that pushes the other stuff out, you know, but.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe you can look at it this way. Think about it. There's a lighthouse 30, 40 miles away. Okay. And it shines this light. And if there was nothing in between you, you'd probably be able to see that light and probably see it pretty clearly, assuming there's no fog, et cetera. You'd be able to see that light pretty clearly. If there was a city full of light in between you, the glare and stuff from those lights would make that thing back there seem pretty insignificant, if not totally disappear. If the power went out on that city, suddenly you'd see that light from that lighthouse pretty clearly.
Okay, I see how you're doing the analogy. That's, I guess, I mean,
remember, what it's doing is it's tuning into a very specific frequency, and if it finds something there, it will catch it. And it feels that it's strong because it's coming from that very same frequency, like I said, a far mile away. But usually, there's stuff in between on that frequency that's much more powerful than that, so it completely makes it go away. It completely subsumes it. And any error correction absorbing just goes in and just takes away.
Okay. I mean, but like, you know, I'd love to intuitively get that. And the other thing is like, you know, like, so the NPR station listens at 90.5. It's at the lower end of the band. Lower, and the lower end ones don't have as much power, I guess, or I don't know if power is the right word. It doesn't have the same kind of reception that the right. commercial stations have higher up in the band, the higher megahertz. At 90.5, when I'm trying, it seems like when you're, it's one of two things. It's either when you're moving, you don't hear or feel the loss in reception caused by certain interference things. But it almost seems like when you're stopped, like close to an intersection, the poles and the lights and everything like interfere with the station. It seems like if you're not stopped like near all those metal poles, it doesn't affect as much, you know?
Yes.
And
those other poles are simply other antennas. And you can, you know, sometimes if I connect my, you know, if you have an auxiliary connection or something to from your phone to your car, sometimes you hear weird noises. Something. If you just grab it, you become the antenna, you have a much larger antenna, and you actually, those sounds will go away because there's a specific frequency in which those, on which the antenna will grab that. And by adding your frequency to that, you've totally taken away the ability for it to absorb that frequency.
Yeah, because like there's times where like I'm stopped at a light and the radio goes out and I try to creep as forward as I can up to the car in front of me and hopefully it comes back in, you know? And it just seems like it's around those poles. And
that's the Faraday effect. I mean, well, that's a Faraday cage, basically. You're things that if you have a mesh of wires, then they'll be at enough, you know, they'll be able to block enough frequencies that they'll just be blocked.
Sure. I mean, but part of the reason I wish I wanted to get is why at 90.5 megahertz these poles affect it, and at, you know, 102 megahertz it doesn't. You know, the commercial stations don't have that problem. Is it power? Or is it frequency? Is it, you know, things like that? So,
well, the frequencies are not that far apart. So my guess would be power. I mean, the ones lower are typically, you know, typically if you're below, was it 92? I think it's your non-commercial. So you have to, you typically aren't able to afford a very powerful transmitter. If you are a commercial station, you buy a gigantic transmitter. The
biggest one you're licensed to use, right?
Now, what would be interesting would be if you were able to do this sort of moving around, but not with a transistor radio like we have now, but with a vacuum tube radio. I bet you'd have a different experience because the way the transistors work is fundamentally different from the way the vacuum tube works. And the way a vacuum tube can receive things is different than the way a transistor receives things. So you won't notice things like cutting out so quickly. It's a much more smooth degradation than it is one or zero, which is you'll notice with transistors.
I see. I mean, so that's one of the pieces of magic that I wish I got more. I've tried reading up on radio, and just nothing's been something I can get my head around. And
Well, I think I understand radio pretty well, though, you know, like you say, it's hard to describe everything in a way that suits everybody. But it's interesting that we brought up the magic thing, because that was a tweet, a couple of tweets I sent out on New Year's after I got home and I got decided to get a little more drunk because I had like one or two things left over. I was like, all right, I'll drink some more of these. There was, I was tweeting about how I was watching some Game of Thrones and finished reading the second book now, and I realized that Game of Thrones and Revolution, that thing on NBC, they have the same premise. Now, you look at me, and I had somebody respond to me saying, you know, the same premise. What I mean, one's on HBO, and it's about new medieval swords and boobs, and one's about, you know, modern day lack of electricity. The premise behind Game of Thrones, for those who haven't read it, is that there, you know, it's medieval land center, but there was at one time this realm like full of magic and sorcery and stuff like that, and that has gone away. The magic is gone.
Okay.
And sort of how the realm deals with that, as there appear to be certain areas where that magic is coming back in small bits.
Okay.
Revolution is essentially the same thing, right? There was a magic, technology, electricity. Mm-hmm. It's now gone. But I assume that there's like small people who have like access to bits of magic.
Yeah, yeah.
The same premise. It's the same premise behind both shows. Now, how they do their show is completely different. But a world without magic colliding, you know, a world without magic colliding against the introduction of magic back into the world.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I probably am going to start catching up on Game of Thrones. I haven't really watched it yet. That and The Wire are probably the two. yeah, I know. I keep saying I'm going to watch The Wire. I am. I have them all. No,
it's funny because they're both good shows. I mean, The Wire is one of the best shows ever made, and Game of Thrones is just a good show. Mm-hmm. Well, what's funny to me is picking out, especially in every HBO thing, but you know, you'll see, wait, Garcetti's in Game of Thrones. You'll see things like that. Okay. You'll see people from The Wire on various shows.
The one show I did watch, it was a pretty light investment, so I checked out. The new show was on FX, American Horror Story. The first season was neat. You know, I think it's the kind of show you really want to watch like on DVD. You want to watch it back to back to back to back to back. You know, and I watched it downloaded and then watched that. And then, you know, the second season, they completely banned the first season storyline. It's a whole new story.
Which I think they kind of have to do in order to make that show work.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, so.
I haven't watched it. I've seen people's description of it, and it's Ryan Murphy who did Glee.
Okay.
He did The New Normal on NBC.
Those.
Yeah, it's not like those, but it's just, I've never been interested in horror stories anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The only one I really liked was, you know, I liked the Joss Whedon one, which was sort of a deconstruction of horror stories.
Yeah, I heard you know, something about it. I figured I'd check it out. And then, you know, I watched a couple of things, and the story was compelling enough to, like, you know, let's burn through these, because there's only, like, I think 10 episodes or something like that.
The basic thing I hear from critics and people who like is that it's a shitty show, but it's a wonderfully shitty show, and that it keeps you like, what the, you don't know what's coming next, and you're sort of like, you're on the edge of your seat to see. I mean, and it's also not the kind of show where you hate watch it. You're not mm-hmm. hating it, and that's why you're watching it. It's just wonderfully fucked up, and you're enjoying that aspect of it.
Well, I mean, you know, like with the first season, the murder house, right? I mean, there's all this like flashback, and like anyone who dies in the house is a ghost, an apparition in the house. So, like, you know, like they're interacting with each other, and it's like, you know, it's like fascinating. Like, how's the, you know, this guy, and then also
there's a guy in rubber.
Yeah,
who turns out to spoilers? Guy never turns out to. I've read about this a little bit. A guy who turns out to be his girl, the daughter's boyfriend, but then he screws the mother too. And there's,
but he's a ghost the entire time. And then the daughter
killed herself.
She tries to commit suicide, and the ghost saves her life, but he doesn't. You don't find out until the end of the season he didn't save her life. She's been a ghost for the last couple episodes. And, you know, so it just goes from there. And then everyone dies at the end. And spoilers. Stop listening if you didn't want to know that.
But the interesting thing is what they did is in order to keep the cast, they changed the location, but they made the cast different people.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that came back from the cast. You know, a couple of characters, I was like, when I saw that, I'm like, oh, it's going to be like all the same people, but a couple, yeah, certain characters, certain, even main characters didn't come back from the second season, but... Second season's it has an interesting plot. It's in 1960s, you know, Catholic asylum, and the doctor there is a Nazi war criminal, and he's making crazy ass.
So I'm not going to comment on the. I haven't read anything about the second season, but I mean, the idea that people could come back, sort of predatory players who come mm-hmm. back, you know, it's very much like, you know, Saturday Night Live. Will they do a different sketch? Are they different? Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, they're players, mm-hmm. you know, or Broadway, you see the same people over and over again in different parts. They're players.
Mm-hmm.
They're actors. They don't have to embody their part everywhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't have a problem with the idea of sort of a anthology series of sorts where every season is a different anthology.
Yeah, so, yeah, I haven't watched too much of the second season yet. I'm not sure if I'm going to keep with it or not. Maybe I should drop that and go back to The Wire. Watch The Wire.
Watch The Wire.
Tell me forever.
Watch The Wire.
I will.
There's no one I know who has not watched The Wire who didn't love it. I mean, like, really just... Mm-hmm. So you have to get past, like I said, about six episodes in the first season. You just got to go because they tell a story differently than any other show you've seen tell a story. And you have to figure out how it's telling that story because mm-hmm. it will continue to do that in all the other seasons. But it's one of those things where it's like three episodes, four episodes, and you're like, what? Who are these people? Why are they connected to each other? And then you sort of realize that it goes on.
I see.
That's why they show me this stuff. And I mean, the thing about The Wire is you see like these investigations and their haphazard starts and the fits and starts they have. And so when they do accomplish something, it's that much more gratifying. You know, when something is accomplished, you see how it started as nothing. And you see how these people started disparate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so
that's cool.
You know, it doesn't start as it's just already together group of people. It starts as a vast array of things. And
any good TV story? It all comes together. January, February.
Community's coming back in February, right. Minus Dan Harmon.
Yeah. Cougar Town's coming back in TBS. I saw a story about that today. I guess there's going to be more. There's going to be some brief nudity and some more, and lots more cleavage or something like that.
Brief? I don't know. I think TBS can get away with nudity. Maybe butts. They could probably do butts.
Maybe butts. I don't. Yeah, is that about brief nudity?
They can't do titties yet.
Oh, I think Justified comes back. That'll be nice. I like Justified.
When does Breaking Bad come back?
Not till summer, I don't think.
Doctor Who comes back, I think, April or something like that.
Downton Abbey starts this week.
Well, Downtown Abbey. I watched me some of that Downtown.
Downtown Julie Brown. That's what we need to name a brown ale. Downtown Julie Brown Ale.
Well, when they make a Downton Abbey brown...
There you go. Maybe Omega Gang will do that for Downton Abbey like they did for Game of Thrones.
All right, I think that's enough.
Yeah, I gotta go to work tomorrow morning. Telephone switch upgrade.
Sunday.
Telephone switch upgrade.
It's Sunday.
I know. Maybe I'll take Monday off, Tuesday, something like that.